Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call to order this hearing of the House Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Today is April 4th, and we have the first order of business is approval of two sets of minutes. So we have the minutes of March 21st. Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair, I move the minutes approval for March 21st.
Okay. Is there any discussion to the minutes of March 21st? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of the minutes of March 21st, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails, and those minutes are approved. And then March 26th, Representative Bierman.
Motion to approve the minutes of March 26th, please, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bierman. So those minutes are moved. Is there any discussion to the minutes of March 26th? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of those minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Thank you. So the first bill on the agenda today is House File 4853. Representative Bierman is coming up. And members will remember we heard this bill informationally, and we had a complete discussion on it. And Representative Bierman is now moving that House File 4853, the first engrossment, be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus. And there is an A2 amendment to put the bill in the order in which Representative Bierman would like to have it discussed. And Representative Bierman, did you want to move the A2?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move the A2 amendment, please. And this just specifies which commissioner is being referred to on those lines.
All right, so technical amendment. So any discussion? All in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. It seems like everybody's kind of waking up yet this morning. All right, Representative Bierman, to your bill as amended.
So thank you, Madam Chair. We had a very good discussion on the bill. The informational hearing, I think, was a good overview, and we had good questions. And members, these are, as mentioned, the basic starting point issues of just in 4853 are what we need for this HMO process to begin reform. We will have more reports coming in June, and we will have much, much more work to do, and look forward to doing that work with all of you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bierman. So is there anyone in the room who wants to testify on the bill who did not testify previously? All right, not seeing anyone. Is there any discussion to be had that has not already been had on this bill? All right, not seeing any. So, oh, sorry, Representative Nadeau.
We can't let him off.
Oh, yes, you can.
I mean, you know, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bierman prides himself on, you know, having conversations with me, and I appreciate that so very, very much. And Representative Bierman, thank you for meeting with me and talking to me about this bill. Ken, you know, when we, as I've stated, I've struggled with the role of the AG in this transaction bill. And the last time we talked about whether or not the AG, and maybe there's somebody here from the AG's office that can answer this, if they're integrally involved in establishing the value, establishing, you know, gathering that information, helping, trying to make a transaction that has never happened in Minnesota before, is what I understand. I preferred one kind of happened, but it was a profit-to-profit, nonprofit. It wasn't really a transition that this bill is trying to do. So it's never happened before. We talked about, you know, how the AG's office could be a party, but yet then is responsible to defend the state in a lawsuit if one would occur. And again, it's all hypothetical because this has never happened. So did you have some more time to think about that and talk to the Attorney General's office about that? Am I completely offline? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Nadeau, for the question, and I enjoyed our conversation immensely. And we will have more of those, I guarantee it, on not only this bill, but many others. I think if the Madam Chair will permit, I would like to bring Ms. Conti down from the AG's office just to speak directly to that point. I think she has a few things to say, which I can try, but I think she would do a better job. So since she's here and willing, we'll bring her up.
All right, welcome to the committee, and Ms. Conti, please introduce yourself for the record. And we want to keep this very brief because we have heard this bill before.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Erin Conti. I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Antitrust Division. Madam Chair and Representative Nadeau, so the Attorney General's office, I guess, could I get your question a little distilled? Because are you asking about how we determine the value or something else?
Representative Nadeau?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you. So as I read the bill, the Attorney General is going to be integrated into valuing and identifying whether or not this transaction is possible, is going to be an integral component. It'll be requesting information, will help guide that transaction in its best case. But my question is does that put the Attorney General in an interesting place if, in fact, that transaction goes south, and now the Attorney General has to defend the state or that public asset that they're trying to glom onto, or my apologies, I didn't mean that, that they're to protect that public asset that has been identified in part by the Attorney General if a party wants to take that to court to fight that?
Ms. Conti.
Madam Chair and Representative Nadeau, so no would be the briefest answer I can provide to that. No, we're not going to be in a space where we are intimately involved in this transaction. This is, some of you may recall from last year's health bill, I came and spoke about how the Attorney General's office reviews nonprofit transactions. And many of the transactions that we're talking about in this bill, because some of these entities are 317A entities, when they transfer substantially all of their assets, they already have some obligations vis-a-vis the Attorney General's office. The Attorney General's office already has to review an all or substantially all type of transaction. We do so, we gather information, we evaluate whether things are being valued appropriately. And our level of involvement really toggles depending on how important the transaction is to Minnesotans, because there is a seemingly endless universe of transactions that we could receive notice of. We focus in on the ones that are of the import. And so in practice, we review some. For some, we issue a no objections letter and send them on their merry way with a waiver. And it really depends on the level of complexity, the level of importance to Minnesotans, and whether or not we see a risk of charitable assets being converted away from their purpose.
Okay. Done?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. So with that, thank you, Representative Bierman. So House File 4853, the first engrossment as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion. All right, we will now move to House File 2607, Representative Finke. Since Representative Finke is not on the committee, the chair will move that House File 2607, the first engrossment, be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus. And I understand there is an author's amendment. Let me just make sure I have the right bill here. 607. Here we go. And we have the A7 amendment. Is your author's amendment, Representative Finke?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
All right. So the chair will move adoption of the A7 amendment to put the bill in the form that the author would like to discuss it. And so all in favor of adoption of the A7 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. And so, Representative Finke, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and members, for the opportunity to present my bill. This being my first time in health, and for the record, my name is Lee Finke. My pronouns are she, her, hers, and I'm very grateful to bring HF 2607. This is a bill that clarifies statutory coverage of gender-affirming care into law. It's the current practice that gender-affirming care is covered, and we want to make sure that all gaps are closed, and that's all that this bill does.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Finke. Could you just briefly tell us what the amendment did as well?
Yes, thank you. The amendment, and I believe that Representative Nadeau had an amendment similar to this today. I'm not sure if that's how it turned out, but it was a religious exemption amendment that codifies a standardized exemption policy for our healthcare coverages. It was adopted in the Senate, by introduced by Senator Hoffman, accepted by Dibble, and was a unanimous support for this change.
Great. Okay. Thank you so much. Okay. We have a number of testifiers lined up to testify on the bill, and we've asked each of them to keep it very brief. So first, Kat Rohn. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. My name is Kat Rohn. I'm the executive director for Outfront Minnesota, our state's largest LGBTQ advocacy organization. This is the issue that brought me into advocacy. When I had my first job out of college, the health insurance plan at my employer had a blanket exclusion on all gender identity related care. And instead of just accepting that, I walked down to the HR office and said, do you know this is here? And a year later, it was changed and that care was covered. I do this advocacy work because I don't want other folks to have that fight on an individual level. Minnesota has been, in large part, providing this care through a series of guidances through our various departments. And we believe that it should be codified into law so that there is clarity for folks seeking best practice health care about what they will receive wherever they go, whether they have a private insurance plan or a public plan. We strongly support this bill. Gender-affirming care is essential health care, and we believe that all folks who need it should have access. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Ash Tifa. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Ash Tifa. I use she and her pronouns. I am Legal Services Program Coordinator at Rainbow Health. A significant portion of what I do in the Rainbow Health Legal Program is identifying folks' barriers to gender-affirming care, identifying them, navigating them, and helping them access the care that they need. Minnesota has done a really great job at minimizing these barriers through these administrative guidances that go back to 2015 that established that Minnesota would deny any policy that prohibits medically necessary gender-affirming care on the grounds that it could be construed as discrimination under Section 1557A of the Affordable Care Act and Minnesota Statute 363A17. So this is long-established policy for nearly a decade, and what this bill is really trying to do is achieve the incorporation of longstanding administrative guidance into statutory law and provide even further clarity for patients, healthcare providers, insurance providers, and regulatory bodies. So everyone knows we're on the same page that medically necessary gender-affirming care is a right that every Minnesotan has. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Susan Ilg. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Hello, Chair Liebling and committee members. My name is Sue Illig and I live in St. Paul. I oppose this legislation because the evidence base for transitioning minors is very poor. Before passing legislation like this bill, I'm asking you to commission a systematic review of the research literature regarding the safety and efficacy of medical transition for minors. Systematic reviews are the cornerstone of evidence-based medicine because they synthesize all of the available research and also examine the quality of research. In recent years, health authorities in Europe have performed systematic reviews of pediatric gender medicine. As a result, Finland's health authorities called the gender reassignment of minors an experimental practice. Swedish health authorities say the risks of treatment likely outweigh the benefits. And in England's NHS banned the use of puberty blockers last month. Even the medical associations that endorse medical transition treatments for minors acknowledge the evidence base is poor. The Endocrine Society documented that almost all of their recommendations for the treatment of adolescents are based on low quality evidence. The World Professional Association for Transgender Health, also known as WPATH, admits that they don't know the long-term impacts of puberty blockers on bone mass, brain development, and sexual health. WPATH, the Endocrine Society, and the American Academy of Pediatrics all acknowledge that following puberty blockers with cross-sex hormones threatens patient fertility, and almost all children who take puberty blockers go on to cross-sex hormones. Please commission a systematic review of the evidence. If the sponsors of this bill are correct that these treatments are safe and beneficial, a systematic review will only strengthen their position. If European countries are correct that these treatments are experimental and dangerous, then kids are getting hurt. And I would sincerely hope that you would want to know that before passing this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Rebecca Delahunt. Welcome to the committee.
Chair Liebling and members of the committee, my name is Rebecca Delahunt and I work as the Director of Public Policy with Minnesota Family Council. HF 2607 requires all physical and mental health plans offered by insurers who operate in Minnesota to not exclude what the bill authors call gender-affirming care, which the policy states must now be designated as medically necessary. Based on the language of this policy, one might assume that the medical community globally has consensus on this issue, but that's not the case. Last year, a Forbes reporter noted how longitudinal data collected and analyzed by public health authorities in Finland, Sweden, and England have concluded that the risk-benefit ratio of pharmaceutical and surgical interventions for youth in this way ranges from unknown to unfavorable. The reporter shared that Finland, Sweden, the UK, and Norway are shifting toward a less medicalized approach that addresses possible psychiatric comorbidities and explores developmental etiology, end quote. The WPATH files released on March 4th show how WPATH has misled the medical community, all while leading insurance companies and legislatures with its protocols. NHS, the health service of the UK, just banned puberty blockers except in the use of clinical trials on March 14th. In short, there is lack of consensus within the global medical community on how to treat minors, and the USA is behind our European neighbors in this understanding. In prior hearings, bill authors have stated that detransitioners will be covered through this bill, but I will note that so-called gender-affirming care was not created with the intent to help folks detransition. There's no WHO ICD-10 code for treating detransition. For detransitioners, the physical and mental impacts of cross-sex hormones and diverse surgeries are broad. This community should not be excluded from care. When we consider this division, forcing all insurers to pay for this is misguided, and forcing all state taxpayers to pay for so-called gender-affirming care is coercion. Children cannot give informed consent on treatment that alters or potentially removes their sexual or reproductive health. Thank you. I ask for a no vote.
Thanks for your testimony. Sam Nelson. Welcome to the committee.
Morning, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. I'm Sam Nelson, outside counsel for the Minnesota Catholic Conference, the public policy voice of Catholics in Minnesota. I also advise many Catholic churches and religious schools throughout Minnesota regarding legal compliance and religious liberty. I can be brief as I came to ask for the religious liberty amendments that have now been included in this bill. So I want to thank this committee and Rep. Finke for including these important religious exemption provisions to ensure that religious employers are not required to pay for coverage and benefits that conflict with their deeply held beliefs. The exemption that's now been included helps ensure that this coverage mandate complies with U.S. Supreme Court cases such as Hobby Lobby and Little Sisters of the Poor. including the religious liberty provisions, provides predictability and uniformity for employers and employees and avoids potential litigation. So again, I want to thank you for including the religious exemption provisions, which uphold Minnesota's values of respecting the diversity of beliefs and values in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. Gloria Marmolejo. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm the mother of a teenager.
And please state your name,
if you would. I'm Gloria Marmolejo. Good morning. And I'm the mother of a teenager with gender dysphoria. I'm a U.S. citizen who has lived in Rochester for almost 30 years. And so thank you, Minnesota representatives, for all your work and for being here today. I want to clarify that my testimony is not tinted by any political affiliation or any organized religion or church. I'm not conservative. I'm not liberal. I'm not even an atheist. I do believe in God. I am just a scientist, a counselor, and a very, very concerned mother about my child with gender dysphoria. And because of that, I have consulted a wide variety of resources that have been mentioned before in some of these testimonies. We probably all agree that gender dysphoria is a condition that needs to receive the same quality of care that any other condition, cancer, heart disease and whatnot, and that unfortunately, this is where we might disagree, that we have been led to believe that the task is easy. We just have to follow the current standards of care, affirm people with gender dysphoria by using their preferred names and pronouns, and then give them easy access to puberty blockers, synthetic cross hormones, and cross-sex surgeries. Some of you may think that then our job today is to pass Bill HF 2607 to require health insurance coverage for gender-affirming care. Then people with gender dysphoria will live happily ever after in our state, right? Well, unfortunately, this is a harmful myth. My child, my family, and multiple friends are being hurt by this system. My child used to be a very happy, confident, and academically skilled girl. Sadly, being a nerd and a second-generation immigrant wasn't considered very cool in middle school. So she experienced long-lasting bullying, exclusion, trauma, resulting in several mental health conditions. She secretly...
I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up your testimony, please.
Yes. She secretly sought refuge in social media and state parental controls. Out of the blue, she notified after being hospitalized that she was not my son. She was not my daughter. She was my son. Now, unfortunately, she has followed the chain, and she has been in testosterone for the last 6 months.
I do have to ask you to please wrap up your testimony.
Sure. My daughter has been damaged for the months that she has been on testosterone. This has interfered with her pre-existing psychiatric conditions. With her therapy, she has landed in the ER, and she has had to visit the hospital multiple times. The solution is not to approve health care for people with gender dysphoria that has not been found to be solidly grounded in empirical evidence. And my child is being a victim of this system.
Okay, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Okay, is there anyone else in the room who wants to testify on the bill? All right, not seeing anyone, we will go to amendments. So there are several amendments filed. Let me see here. We have the A5 amendment. Is that? No, we're not offering the A5.
Yeah.
Nadeau? Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to be helpful. thank you, Representative Finke, for meeting with me yesterday. And so there's no surprises with what I'm, you know, what I'm doing. And so, Madam Chair and members, what this amendment does is this amendment just ensures that if we pass this law, that medically necessary gender-affirming care also includes a transition. Thank you. Sorry about that. Mm-hmm. Detransitioning. And when we talked about this yesterday, Representative Finke assured me that the way that we look at this is transitioning is, you know, it is what it is, in any way. So, I do recognize that this might be comfort language, but I still think it's an important thing to try to put in the law so that it's fully clear and it's simple and it's understood. That if this moves forward, that it is full coverage. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and Representative Nadeau. I also appreciate the conversation that we had yesterday about this amendment. I'm going to ask members to vote against this amendment, and it's not because I don't appreciate the concern that's being brought. Detransition is a real thing. Gender-affirming care covers detransition. Even since our conversation, I had multiple conversations, and I know our testifier did as well, to ensure that fact is true. And we don't want to interrupt anyone's necessary medication. I will just add that I'm prone to not add comfort language. I had carried a bill last year to remove some comfort language from 1993, and that at great personal cost. So I would like to avoid that. The bill covers what we're doing, and I think it's good.
All right. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I feel that acknowledging gender fluidity is not unidirectional, should be plain language in the bill. And I'm shocked that we would not include this language. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Finke. I would hope that members of the committee will choose to vote their conscience on this. You know, I mean, a lot of legislation was passed last session that was all comfort language. Frankly, the entire abortion issue that was litigated last session was effectively comfort language. Our Supreme Court has already established what that is, and guess what? The Minnesota State Supreme Court isn't changing their minds. So, there is a very good reason to include this kind of language and ensure that everyone is protected. And again, especially if we don't think that it alters the underlying bill and it doesn't alter the intent of the bill, it just makes sense to affirmatively say that we are going to ensure that everyone is taken care of. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, I'd request a roll call vote.
All right, roll call having been requested, there will be a roll call. Is there any more discussion? All right, seeing none, the clerk will take the roll on the A5 amendment. The chair votes no.
Chair Liebling, no. Vice Chair Bierman?
No.
Bierman, no. Lee Schumacher?
Schumacher, aye.
Schumacher, aye. Representative Akam?
No.
Akam, no. Representative Backer?
Backer votes aye.
Backer, aye. Representative Bonner?
No.
Bonner, no. Representative Carroll?
No.
Carroll, no. Representative Elkins?
No.
Elkins, no. Representative Fisher?
Fisher, no.
Fisher, no. Representative Hemmingson-Yeager?
No.
Hemmingson-Yeager, no. Representative Herr?
No.
Herr, no. Representative Keel?
Keel, aye.
Keel, aye. Representative Murphy?
Yes.
Murphy, aye. Representative Nadeau?
Aye.
Nadeau, aye. Representative New Brindley?
Yes.
New Brindley, aye. Representative Perryman?
Perryman, aye.
Perryman, aye. Representative Quam?
Yes.
Quam, aye. Representative Ryer?
No.
Ryer? No. Representative Smith?
No.
Smith? No.
There being 8 ayes and 11 nays, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Okay, we are now, there's an A6, and I assume that is withdrawn. Is that correct? That was the one that was the same as what was adopted or close to it. Representative Keough?
Yes, that is withdrawn. Okay. It is included in the A7.
Thank you. Okay, let's go to the A8, which is also Representative Doe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This amendment, so, you know, we've moved quickly last session to establish Minnesota as a refuge for gender-affirming care, and other states are moving just as quickly in the opposite direction, and honestly, it's far too often about politics. And, you know, Minnesota has had this incredibly strong history of reviewing, evaluating treatments, and policies, always searching to find that proper balance between benefits, patient safety, the cost, and the evidence to defend those decisions. If we're going to proceed down this path that provides medical transition treatments, I think long before we should be talking about whether or not health plans pay or whoever pays for the cost of care, I think we should be leading the nation by creating a commission that's charged with reviewing the research regarding the safety and efficacy of treatments for children, adolescents, and adults. I've just started trying to learn about this since last session, and I appreciate that. And I've learned that the prevalence of gender dysphoria, it's super difficult to determine. Recent studies show that between, 0.4% and 0.6% of adults identify as transgender. Higher percentages now among adolescents, 1.2 to 4.1% of adolescents are reporting gender identity different from assigned at birth. And not all children and youth who report these gender identities different from those assigned at birth ever experience that persistent gender dysphoria that I think is what we're trying to really work on here. And the trajectory of gender dysphoria in children is different from that of gender dysphoria presenting in adolescents. And these, I think, are vital considerations that I think we need to be trying to address. Thankfully, the medical community has moved away from their previous consensus of viewing gender variance as a disease model and an affirming one. It's continuing to adopt those practices, recognizing that there's minimal research and even less longitudinal research on adolescents. So in the last several years, based on the research that I've been working on, health authorities in those areas across the globe that are far ahead of us in this specialty have started questioning the pediatric medical transition treatments, and they're starting to rethink some of the things that were acceptable before. So, Madam Chair and Representative Finke, my A8 amendment, I think what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to protect gender-affirming care for adolescents by focusing those treatments and standards on care through counseling, through supportive psychotherapy that allow youth, families, care providers the opportunity in a supportive environment to care for youth, but preserving medical and surgical interventions until after the age of 21. And so that's what my A8 amendment does. It creates another definition of adolescent gender-affirming care that restricts medical and surgical treatments. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Nadeau for your amendment. Again, I appreciate the conversation. We had a really excellent conversation about this yesterday, and I believe you that you want to protect kids. You want to make sure that we are providing young people with necessary care that will be good for who they are for their whole life. And it's gender-affirming care only doesn't do that if you believe that gender-affirming care is not health care. If you believe that gender-affirming care is health care, then we understand that we need to provide medically necessary care to those who need it. You said it's often political when we get into these conversations. I did, to avoid being political, I didn't print this, but I thought about it. In the last 3 years, Republican states in very overwhelming conservative states have passed bans on gender-affirming care for minors. And three of those states actually, the governors, the very, very conservative governors of those states, vetoed that law. And they vetoed that because before they signed it, they did their work. Governors of Utah, Arkansas, and Ohio. And they met with families, and they met with doctors, and they met with trans kids, and they said, we should not do this. So I did not print the veto letter from the governor of Ohio, Mike DeWine, but I would encourage you to read it. I would encourage us to recognize that if this is healthcare, then it is families and doctors who should provide it, and it is families and doctors who should decide when, and it is not up to us. And I would just add that this amendment also, I'm not sure why, but it increases the age of the minor from 18 to 21, and other states are increasing it to 25. Other people are just going after adults, and we're seeing the scope creep of attacks against what, if you don't consider health care, you can do what you want, but this is life-affirming health care. Please vote no.
Thank you. All right, all in favor of the you weren't on the list, Representative New Brindley. You hadn't raised your hand, and we are in the middle of a vote, so we're going to vote. All in favor of adoption of the A8 amendment, please say aye.
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 All opposed?
No.
The motion does not prevail, and the amendment is not adopted. Members, if you want to be on the list, get on the list, and don't do it while we're voting. Well, you've been doing this a while, Representative New Brindley. Usually you don't need to be invited. So we have disposed of the amendment. So is there any discussion to the bill as amended? Representative New Brindley.
Yes. I did not notice this actually in the A7, or I would have had an amendment to the amendment, unfortunately. But I just want to be clear, on lines 5.25 to 5.28, there is no cost sharing whatsoever for any of this treatment or procedures without respect to income limits or anything else.
Representative Finke?
I'm sorry, just to be clear, we're talking about the A7 amendment?
Correct.
On 525?
Correct.
Representative New Brindley, could you pull the mic toward you, please?
Yes, absolutely. Lines 5.25 to 5.28. Did you want me to repeat that point?
Representative New Brindley, why don't you go ahead and repeat it?
Yeah. Sure. I like I said, I missed this in the A7 and was just reviewing it, and I just want to make sure I'm clear that lines 5.25 to 5.28 would indicate that there is no cost sharing that is allowable, no co-payments, no co-insurance, nothing regardless of income or ability to pay.
Representative Finke?
Thank you, Chair Liebling and Representative. I think that research has something on. Is there something about this piece, or maybe one of our testifiers who were involved in the Senate side could describe how this language is working?
Ms. Clarkfist.
Madam Chair and Representative New Brindley, this language on 5.25 to 5.28 only applies to coverage that's an accommodation for an eligible organization. This provides there's no cost sharing for coverage for enrollees under a health plan offered by an eligible organization that otherwise declines to provide this coverage. The general language of the gender-affirming care bill would allow for cost sharing.
Okay, thank you.
Representative New Brindley?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can the author tell me what specific scientific studies you used to, refine and do the background and do the language for this bill?
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and Representative Quam. Yes, I used the research that was done by every major medical organization in the United States, as well as the WPATH internationally. There is no medical debate in America's medical associations about the necessary quality, the necessary, medically necessary gender-affirming care provisions. There is debate about it, but every major medical organization recognizes that gender-affirming care is necessary life-affirming health care and should be provided. I would also like to, if I may, take a moment and say that, you know, we hear a lot about the Nordic countries and the Nordic countries changing their policies around gender-affirming care, Nordic countries and UK, and we do not have time for a geopolitical analysis, but Southern European countries are going the other way. That's because we have been politicized. This is a political issue. Many people are hearing about us and debating us and deciding our decisions as though we have not been receiving gender-affirming care. Gender-affirming care has always existed, y'all. It's not new. It's not 3 years old. It's not 5 years old. It's been being provided in Minnesota for decades. The idea that you are learning about who we are is happening not because of a decision we made. It is a decision that was made by conservatives to politicize us for political gain. And I can show you that research too. They chose it, they threw everything at the wall, and trans kids stuck. So the research is there, the attack is not scientific, it is political, and we can show you the receipts.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Quam, follow.
Well, the answer, the author didn't give an answer. He dropped into a political diatribe, didn't note one
and
specific.
Quam,
Madam Chair.
Representative Quam, excuse me. We need to use the correct pronouns, please.
Okay. The author did not answer the question because the author gave no, how should we say, scientific study. He referenced general
Representative
discussions.
Quam,
ma'am, can I? I'm
pronoun.
Asking for information. I said the author. I said the author. Okay, Madam Chair, let me go on. There was a testifier that made a slight error in the statement when they said that the UK allows clinical trials. The actual UK allows only approved, pre-approved clinical trials. But looking at actual scientific studies, like a 15-year-long longitudinal study over thousands of children that had gender confusion. They questioned their gender. The vast majority by the mid-20s no longer, that disappeared. And the scientific studies I've been looking at from multiple countries over multiple years have all indicated that there is no distinct and statistically significant indication of improvement from puberty blockers and the surgery when it comes into, in fact, there were control groups that looked at a controlled group, and then outside, and there was no statistical difference for suicide and those issues. But there are, in the studies, issues where puberty blockers have caused health problems and conditions in later life. And there's a list of those I can send the author, since the author apparently is not familiar with the scientific study, so and couldn't quote me any that the author utilized for the writing of this bill. And my whole point is, when we make decisions, we should actually use science, not drop into diatribes about politics back and forth. And when I was young, Denmark and other countries were way ahead of procedures, and that was mainly focused on adults. And I think the main debate here is permanent life-changing procedures for children, adolescents, some pre-pubescent, and frankly, as a human race, we have had adults protecting children until they could make the decisions as an adult. So the whole debate should be based on scientific studies and should be based on long-term concern and care for children. I haven't heard anyone debating adult treatment, but permanent life-changing treatment to children has been something that we have been very cautious as a human race. That's why parents have the, you know, authority, medical authority over kids. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And so we have four members on the list, and then so we have Nadeau, Fisher, New Brindley, and Keel. And so I know there's a so Fisher, New Brindley, and Keel. But I, Representative Finke, if you would just, rather than, you know, I don't know, I'm sure you want to respond, but rather than kind of go back and forth, if you could kind of make some notes, and then at the end I'll give you an opportunity to wrap up and respond. I think that would be possibly the most efficient way to proceed here, if that's okay with you. So, Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Finke, for bringing this bill forward. This is something that I've followed for many years. Having worked in the homeless youth world since 2007, a lot of the youth that we worked with were people who were dealing with gender dysphoria. And back at that time, I did a lot of self-education, taking a look at what does the science say at that time? What does the medical procedure say at that time? And everything, and this is going back to 2007, so this is not something that's been overnight or whatsoever. This is literature that I keep on going back to and referring to, that the procedures that are out there are very necessary, particularly when you're dealing with youth or people who've got extreme forms of gender dysphoria, that sometimes the only way they can prevent suicide is to go on to the next steps. And that's one of the things that I've seen over time, is that when youth have been able to come out as who they are, they thrive. When they aren't, the depression that they deal with and the lack of acceptance in society that they deal with is so horrible that sometimes they're driven to take matters into their own hands, and which usually ends up in suicide. So when we talk about this, this is basic health care. When I take a look, you've got an option between suicide or having procedures that will help make you who you are. I think that is gender-affirming care. And the studies that I've seen over time reaffirm that. And this is going back over years. And so this is why I'm a strong supporter of this bill. It helps save lives.
Thank you, Representative Fisher. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just need to address this idea that, you know, the author just told everyone that that these objections are politically motivated by conservatives. And that needs to be addressed. I personally have done a lot of soul searching over the last few years about what my hierarchy of values includes. And as part of that, I supported the ban on conversion therapy last year because it occurred to me that parental rights was actually not the highest level of priority. Protecting kids was the highest level of priority. And so to suggest that our objections here are politically motivated, implying that they are somehow just mean-spirited, and that we don't actually care about these issues deeply, is not just offensive, but it is wrong. And as Representative Quam said, I have not heard a single member of my caucus argue once against gender-affirming care for adults. And in fact, I've said very clearly, adults get to do what adults want to do, and they should live their best lives. I think it's a little funny that the other side of the aisle here passed age 21 for tobacco. Like, kids up to age 21 can't possibly use tobacco, but it's perfectly okay for them to make permanent changes that cannot be reversed. Hormone therapy alone has permanent changes that can never be reversed, including sometimes that child will never experience an orgasm, not in their entire lives. That's the reality of this when this happens for children. Surgeries that can never be reversed. That's the reality of this. This is not political for us. We actually think that there is a great deal of potential harm for the children that I 100% believe you are trying to help. There's no doubt in my mind, I tell everyone, the people who serve in this legislature are good, decent people who are trying to do the right thing. We just disagree to orders of magnitude on what that is. But I certainly believe that your intention is to help children. Parents are told that their children are going to kill themselves if they don't do this. They're not told that their children are likely to be suicidal after they do this, which is in the data. So while we disagree on what the right thing is for these minors, don't you dare tell me that this is politically motivated. I have put my own reputation on the line. I will do it every time. I get it from both sides of the aisle, from Republicans and Democrats. They don't like my stand because, frankly, on these kinds of issues, parents shouldn't have the final say. We, as responsible adults and lawmakers, should have the welfare of children as our primary, above all else, moral compass. And this bill certainly does not do that.
All right. Thank you. I'm going to go to Representative Keel, but I just want to remind everyone the bill is about coverage, insurance coverage. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Finke, I downloaded some information from the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism to research exactly what Representative New Brindley said. How do I know what's happening? How does this affect especially our children? And I think we need to make sure that we know the long-term effects. I wouldn't take my child to get an appendectomy that they need or a tonsillectomy or something that is just normal to do if I thought it wasn't necessary. Or the other way around, the doctor explains, well, this is a problem, and this child needs this done because they will die. And there is some really concerning information in this endocrinology report that leads back to 2009. So it's not recent, more recent, but my concern is, have you had chance to read this information and what it does to our underage 21 years and under, especially 18 and under? Have you been able to read that?
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. I'm sure I have not read that endocrinology journal article that you found on the internet.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It is a journal that they put out from clinical, it's a Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. can't even say that word. But my concern is that we're only looking for certain information to affirm what it is that we want to do. I understand the medical coverage in this. However, I would have real concerns about not knowing the detail of what I would be asked to pay for, much less take care of my child. And I would encourage you to read this because it has some really concerning issues as far as lifestyle of existence after those things are done, such as bone density, heart concerns. There are some real changes in what we're talking about doing to children that are especially prepubescent, but also, you know, just have not gone through puberty and, you know, mentally questioning who they are, much less physically deciding permanent changes. Like Representative New Brindley said, these are life-challenging decisions, and our children need to understand what it is they're choosing and their parents. So thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Ryer. And then we're going to go to Representative Finke to close up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Finke. I appreciate your carrying this legislation and your advocacy. I want to note that parts of the conversation have been, this is not about adults. We want to support adults to live their best life, live who they are. And I want to remind us that harmful disregard of someone's preferred chosen pronouns directly conflicts with the message that we want to affirm people and let adults and encourage adults to live their best lives. Further, I want to say that gender-affirming care for all ages is a range of treatment. It's a range of choices they make, from clothes, from name to hair, and yes, pronouns. And when we misuse pronouns and when we intentionally or deliberately misuse them or choose not to be careful, we're sending messages to our kids also that we don't care how they're seeing the world and we are willing to do them harm. And the very act of doing that is an act of disrespect and violence against people, regardless of who they are. I personally think that when we misgender people, and yes, I do it sometimes, it's a habit, I apologize and I work to do better. And I would call on all of my colleagues to apologize when they misgender and resolve to do better.
Thank you. And I'm sorry, I missed Representative Smith. So last comment, Representative Smith, then we'll go to Representative Finke.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Rep. Finke, for bringing this bill. And Representative Ryer said a couple things that I thought was important to highlight, that we are hearing some folks say that this is just a scientific discussion. And yet even in the small window that we've been discussing this in this committee, we have heard one member refer to other operations as normal, reflecting that this is in some way abnormal, which it is not. One member refused to use correct pronouns, and when corrected, would still refuse to use them. The author's competency has been called into question time and time again, and I can assure you that she has done the research and has shown time and time again that she has done the research. And once again, as the chair rightly stated, this is a bill about medical coverage. We are not requiring anyone to get this operation. We are making sure that families have the option, that this is covered, that it is affordable, that it is accessible. We are not the ones, and when I say we, I mean Democrats, the DFL, people on this committee who are going to vote yes on this bill, are not in the business of saying people cannot get a medical procedure. We want that option to be available to people.
We said that last year.
All right. Thank you. Representative Finke, final word.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, and members, for the spirited debate. I have a few comments I'd like to make in response to some of the testimony or some of the members, and then we'll just close out this conversation. First, you know, there are when you were doing medical research, people disagree. You know, I know that there are endocrinologists out there who are studying this. I also know that the Pediatric Endocrine Society, the Endocrine Society, and the American Academy of Endocrinology all believe that gender-affirming care is necessary health care and advise its administration to children as necessary. It's not because no one anywhere ever thinks we should ask questions. Of course we don't think that. We should not pretend like the people who do the science and make the decisions and understand the medical history and reasoning are behind us. I also want to say that to Representative Quam's point, you know, most people do not grow out of being trans. A recent study by the NCTE, the largest ever done, of 96,000 trans people in America, this just came out a couple weeks ago, it found that 95% of trans people are more satisfied with their lives after transition than they were before. Only 3% said that they were less satisfied. If you go to any healthcare arena and say 95% of your patients will be more satisfied with their life after their healthcare, that is an astonishing rate, an astonishing medical rate of success. We do not do this for other forms of healthcare. We do not ask an entire country to account for healthcare when that healthcare is overwhelmingly supported by the medical and individual patient world. We do not do this. We are doing this for other reasons. I don't know what they are, and it's not a personal attack on anyone. I will say that, you know, my experience here has probably been different in terms of how people are or are not good about what they disagree with. We can disagree about what it means to make policy, but this is not a question that I'm willing to entertain disagreement about, whether or not trans people should have access to their care. I'm grateful to my colleagues who have lifted me up and lifted up the work that we have done this past year and a half. If you are not hearing anyone on your side talk about adult health care for trans people, I have some messages I can send you, some video clips I can send you that they are, in fact, on your side in this body coming for trans health care for adults. This is not hypothetical. We're just trying to live our lives. I hate this. I hate this. I don't want to do this. We never had to do this before, and now we have to sit here and do this because we wanted health care. And some people decided we shouldn't have it anymore. So please support the bill. We're already doing this. We don't even have surgeries in Minnesota under 18. Representative Quam said that parents should be over the medical control of their children. While I don't love that phrase, no gender-affirming care in Minnesota is provided without parental consent. The things that you're saying aren't true. The things that we experience and report back are true because we live our own lives. Please support the bill.
Thank you very much, Representative Finke. With that, House File 2607, the first engrossment as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus. Thank you. Thank you to all the testifiers. Okay. Representative Stevenson. House File 4053, and the chair will move that House File 4053 be laid over for possible inclusion. There is an author's amendment, so the chair will move the A5 to put the bill in the form that the author would like to have it discussed. Is that the correct amendment, Representative Stevenson, the A5?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right, so we will adopt the A5. So all in favor of adoption of the A5 amendment, please say aye. I'm sorry, Representative New Brindley. Go ahead.
I'm wondering actually if Ms. Clarkquist could explain. You know, I was continuing to review that same language from the last amendment, and I'm wondering if you could just give us an example of how. I'm just wondering how that plays out when they're not covered anyway. How would cost sharing play into that? Does that question make sense,
Ms. Clarkquist?
Madam Chair and Representative Newbrinley, it does make sense, and perhaps someone from the Commerce Department could talk about the mechanics of coverage, because the services are still covered. They're just not covered by the employer health plan. That's the accommodation.
Okay. Representative Newbrinley?
But they would still be covered by the insurance company?
Correct.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
All right, so all in favor, no other questions about the A5? All in favor of adoption of the A5 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The A5 is adopted. So, Representative Stevenson, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and in recognition of the sort of lateness of the, I see how far we are into the committee hearing, and so I won't belabor what this bill is or what it does. I'll just say that this is a bill to require coverage of abortion in Minnesota. Just a few statistics. In 2021, over 25% of people who needed abortion care in Minnesota were forced to pay out of pocket because so few plans cover abortion. None of the insurance plans sold on Minsure cover abortion outside of narrow instances. And members, abortion is health care, and health insurance isn't worth very much if it doesn't cover the care that you need, which is why the bill is necessary. The A5 amendment that you just adopted adds a tailored religious exemption in line with what we've done on other bills in the past. It also incorporates cost sharing. That was some feedback we got in the Commerce Committee. Was happy to make that change after some discussions and thought about it since the Commerce Committee. So with that, Madam Chair, I know there are other amendments and testifiers and things that the committee needs to do.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. So we have a list of testifiers, and the first on the list is Dr. Nicole Chasen, if I'm saying that okay. Welcome, and please state your name for the record and go ahead and give us your testimony, and again asking all the testifiers to limit their testimony to 2 minutes.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Liebling and members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify for the Abortion Coverage Act, House File 4053. My name is Nicole Chasen. I'm a board-certified family physician practicing in Minneapolis, where I provide full-spectrum reproductive health care, including abortion care, to patients across the reproductive lifespan. I'm also a member of the Minnesota Cluster of the Reproductive Health Access Network, which is an interprofessional collective of clinicians across Minnesota mobilizing to expand sexual and reproductive health care advocacy and provision. Many of my patients are in prepaid medical assistance programs that are managed by different insurance companies. Unfortunately, many of these PMAP plans do not specifically cover abortion services unless there is an exception listed, requiring the providers like me jump through many hoops to get that patient's needed abortion covered if we can. And coverage on the MinSure exchange, as Representative Stevenson said, is even worse. No plans cover abortion care. Unfortunately, this isn't always clear to patients that are seeing these plans cover patient pregnancy-related care when they are comparing services and costs. Abortion care is pregnancy-related care. Insurance companies excluding abortion from their pregnancy-related services is false advertising. Excluding these services delays care that's often needed urgently or puts it entirely out of reach. It causes financial burdens that for some are insurmountable. I had a patient delay care for over a week to find the money to pay for her medical abortion, an out-of-pocket cost of over $100, which was tough to cover for this really busy mom who is also trying to feed her family. My patients should not have to balance their basic needs against their access to medically necessary care. It's just not fair for people to pay for health insurance that doesn't cover all the services they might need. And it's not right for the health insurance companies to deny coverage for services that our state regards as an intrinsic part of full-spectrum essential health care. 11 other states require insurance coverage for abortion, and if we are truly to fulfill the commitment we've made to reproductive freedom and health care access here in Minnesota, we need to join them. As long as insurance companies discriminate against people who need abortion, the stigma and financial barriers impeding access to abortion will continue. And those who are already financially strapped and burdened by unequal access to care will be the most vulnerable. Abortion care is health care, no exceptions, and it's time to pass this act. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Monica Meyer? Welcome to the committee.
Hello, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. I'm Monica Meyer, the political director of Gender Justice, and I'm here in support of the Abortion Coverage Act. Through our work to advance gender equity and secure reproductive freedom, we know the harm that barriers to abortion access cause. We know the desperate measures that people resort to when insurance providers deny them coverage for abortion care. Pawning wedding rings, forgoing shopping trips for a month, selling their stove. These are true stories we've heard from people who had health insurance but were denied coverage in whole or in part for the abortion care they needed. They face the prospect of absorbing unexpected out-of-pocket costs of $750 or more, and that's a significant expense for everyone, and people who are insured and paying premiums are being forced to pay for that time-sensitive care on their own due to politics. If there's one thing that Minnesotans have made clear over the past couple of years, it's that reproductive freedom is central to our values. In polling, Minnesotans have told us that they overwhelmingly support abortion rights, and also that they want abortion care to be accessible and affordable for everyone. Nearly 70% say that they want everyone in the state to have access to abortion regardless of location or financial status. This legislature has responded forcefully and resoundingly. You've gone to great lengths to change our state laws to ensure that they regard abortion care, as the majority of Minnesotans do, as an essential health care service. But not all of the insurance providers have gotten that memo. They still choose to cover abortion care only in limited circumstances, like rape and incest, or not at all. And too many of them have made that unfortunate choice. This hurts providers, it hurts people, it delays care that's often needed urgently, or puts it entirely out of reach. It's time to clear away one more of the barriers of abortion access standing between Minnesotans and the care they need. Thank you, Chair Liebling and representatives.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Kathy Blazer? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I apologize. I don't know whether right now to say good morning or good afternoon. I apologize as well. I had not seen the A5 amendment up to this point. I just briefly perused it online. And I would just simply say that while we're grateful to see a religious exemption, and that does help us move toward more constitutionally protected rights within this bill, there are many Minnesotan individuals, organizations, and healthcare providers, healthcare plan providers, that would come to a conviction that elective abortions involve the unjust killing of defenseless, innocent human beings, not just from religious conviction, but from simple biological reality, simple biological science that tells us that that is a human baby, a human being that is developing in the womb, or from a simple understanding that every human being deserves their human rights to be protected from lethal violence. And so I would just ask legislators to please ensure that not just religious, but conscience exemptions are included in this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Karen Adante, followed by Renee Carlson. Welcome to the committee.
Hello, I'm Karen Adante from Mendota Heights, and I'm speaking in opposition to House File 4053. As a Catholic, my right to live my faith continues to be threatened by bills like this. Abortion is a serious offense against my conscience and that of many people of faith. And this bill would force me to be an accomplice to elective abortions by making me pay for them through my insurance premiums. The term abortion has been convoluted, so I want to be clear. I'm not talking about life-saving health care to treat things such as ectopic pregnancies and miscarriages. That health care has always been available as it should be. But in 2022, there were over 12,000 abortions in Minnesota, nearly all elective. it is not medically necessary to intentionally end the life of a preborn baby because a good doctor, using our amazing advances in medicine, can treat the mother and the baby. If the baby dies, it's a tragedy, but it's not an abortion because life-saving care was provided. I'm horrified knowing that babies are being killed in the womb simply because of things like a Down syndrome diagnosis, sex selection, in many cases because it's, quote, just not the right time to have a baby, or because the woman is forced by someone to have an abortion. I never imagined killing preborn babies because of perceived imperfections, undesirable traits, or timing would be considered essential health care. Yet here we are. But people of faith like me know that ending the lives of these preborn babies is wrong. I cannot fathom being forced to be an accomplice to tens of thousands of abortions every year simply because these babies are not wanted. Pope Francis tells us we must protect the unborn and compares abortion to hiring a hitman. I should not have to participate in that injustice. I urge you to vote no and protect our conscience rights. Thank you.
Thank you. Renee Carlson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we're still on. Good morning. Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Renee Carlson. I serve as general counsel for True North Legal. Members, Minnesota should seek to pass laws that support and protect women's health. However, the underlying policy of this bill will never achieve that objective because women deserve health care, not the abortion industry. In fact, we know that according to the FDA's own label, one in 25 women who take high-risk abortion drugs will end up in the emergency room. This fact alone substantiates the U.S. Supreme Court's recognition that there are common and respectable reasons for opposing abortions, including religious beliefs about abortion shared by diverse faith communities in Minnesota. Without question, the free exercise of religion extends to decisions regarding abortion, as clearly articulated in the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Hobby Lobby v. Burwell. Here, the court struck down the HHS regulation requiring business owners to provide health insurance coverage for their employees when doing so conflicted with the business owner's religious beliefs about abortion, making clear that conscience rights, including conscience rights of business owners, may not be infringed in this way. There have been amendments adopted that speak to this issue, and I think it's important to put on the record that those amendments must go forward or else this bill would be unconstitutional. It would never survive the strict scrutiny analysis that would be applied to it because although Hobby Lobby applied RFRA, that same strict scrutiny analysis would apply to this bill, and without an amendment for conscious objections, it would not survive in the courts. While we disagree with the policy in this bill, in the very least, members of this committee should ensure that this bill does not move forward without legal protections for employers whose deeply held religious beliefs and conscientious objections forbid them from being complicit in abortion, including paying for abortion. Members, I thank you for your time, and I have additional testimony submitted written for the record. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the room who wants to testify on the bill? Not seeing anyone, so we will go. I have Representative Nadeau on the list, but we have some amendments. Did you want to speak before we take up the amendments, Representative Nadeau?
No, I can wait until after.
Okay. All right. So that being the case,
we'll wait till after.
Okay. So we will then go to the amendments. So I think Representative New Brindley has the A6 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'd like to move the A6 amendment, which, and I assume this is no surprise. We talked about this in the Commerce Committee. But this coverage mandate is very unique in that it actually prohibits any cost sharing. So this amendment simply deletes lines 3.9 to 3.16 that prohibit any cost sharing and puts this on par with any other coverage mandate. And frankly, the reason for this, I hope, is obvious, right? Like when cost sharing, as the chair pointed out, has already been eliminated for Medicaid, which I was on the record last year in support of. I think that was a good move. does not make sense to require cost sharing for those most in need of help with their health care. However, the underlying bill language eliminates cost sharing for everyone, whether they can afford it or not. And it's unique to this. So, you know, I mean, we have lots of mandated coverage, you know, even things like mammograms and things like this that still allow for cost sharing. Frankly, rightfully so. It's okay. When someone makes a really good living, it's okay for them to participate in the cost of their health care. And again, I speak from experience, and I was not wealthy when we incurred a great deal of costs for health care, but we could afford it. And so it was the right thing to do to participate in the cost of that health care. This creates a really strange exception to cost sharing that we don't see in other mandated coverage. And frankly, doesn't make sense when folks can pay for their health care. And again, it's already been eliminated for those who it is most difficult for. So hopefully the bill author will see this as a friendly amendment. And I would ask for a yes vote. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, I think it's very friendly, Representative New Brindley. Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative New Brindley. So friendly, in fact, we incorporated a provision of that into the A5 amendment that was already adopted. So if you take a look at line 3.2, so we had this discussion in the Commerce Committee. I heard your point. I thought about it. What I was concerned about with the cost sharing was that there would be a discriminatory impact of a cost sharing, that a plan could require cost sharing in such a way as to make the coverage not workable simply because of abortion. So if you look at on the A5, line 3.2, we allow cost sharing as long as it's not inconsistent with how it's done for other services. And I see Representative Brindley looks puzzled, so I don't know. Yeah. But the intent was
to
do.
Are you sure line 3.2?
On the A5?
I think I've got the A.
Let's see. Well,
3.20.
Okay. I'm sorry. Yes, you're right. I left off the zero.
Okay.
My apologies.
Let me look at that one.
I even have it like boxed here.
Let's observe decorum here. I'm sorry.
I apologize.
You know, I know it's tempting, but yeah. Okay.
So I would encourage a no vote on the amendment, just because I like the approach that we took in the A5 better than simply deleting the cost sharing provision. But the intention was to allow for some cost sharing as long as it's not discriminatory.
So, Representative New Brindley, do you still want to vote on your amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, to make sure I understand the language in the A5, that they can't impose higher cost sharing than it is required to other services. Am I understanding that correctly?
Representative Stevenson.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Stevenson. I would withdraw the amendment. Thank
you. All right. Thank you. The A6 is withdrawn. See that, Representative New Brindley? We listen to you. Representative Stevenson listens.
And I thanked him for that.
And, okay, let's see. We have now the A7 amendment. Is that yours, Representative New Brindley?
Correct. Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move the A7 amendment. And once again, this is a little bit unique to these services that we don't normally do this. There are some, basically what this does is right now, in lines 2.21 to 2.27, some of these, most of this is already underlying language and statute, and the underlying bill removes the exception to abortion services. And it is unusual that we don't require folks or allow in-network provision for insurers. But for some reason, we have said that these things cannot be restricted by network. And frankly, there's a reason we have networks, right? I mean, it ultimately is about saving cost savings for everyone on an insurance plan. Now, there are some things that we do this for. Like, we've done this with rare diseases because, frankly, it could be that the only place care is available is maybe Tennessee or something like that, right? For a rare disease where it's not easily accessible. I mean, maybe it's possible, but I can't imagine that there's a situation where all of these things are not available in network, and my amendment would still allow a health plan. It would still, in fact, require a health plan to cover these services out of network if it is not available in network. So hopefully that's not too confusing. But again, this is sort of a strange exception for these particular services that doesn't make a ton of sense. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd ask for a no vote on the A7. So as Representative New Brinley mentioned, this language that's in Section 4 of the bill, the underlying language, Chapter 62Q.14, is longstanding language in Minnesota. It's been around since the 90s, and it relates to much more than just abortion. It also relates to infertility, STD treatment, AIDS and HIV-related treatment, and the amendment that Representative New Brinley is offering would change the way we treat everything, not just abortion. So it kind of expands the scope of the bill beyond just how we cover abortion and deals with coverage of many other things. And I don't think that this bill should be the vehicle to have that particular expanded discussion. I think also Representative Newman kind of hinted at this, but I think the reason why we have this in law currently is oftentimes some of these services might not be readily available. That is particularly true with regard to abortion, where it might not be available in your network if you live in a certain part of the state. So I would oppose the amendment as it applies to abortion, and more strongly oppose it as it applies to all of the other services that are listed in 62Q.14.
All right. Seeing no further discussion to the amendment, did you have more discussion to the amendment?
Yeah.
Representative Brindley? Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I would just point out that, I mean, obviously this stricken language is in this section of statute. I mean, it's certainly very, very applicable. And frankly, I think it is I think it's a little disingenuous to suggest that these things are not widely available. It's just a little disingenuous. It is wildly out of step with how we do coverage for almost anything else without really good reason. This is all available in network, and I hope we choose to do the right thing and vote yes on the amendment. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Doe, did you want to speak to this amendment?
Just to this amendment, yes. And I think this is, and I appreciate Representative Stevenson talking about how this affects other things, but I think this section of statute is really about testing, diagnosis. We're opening this up to a coverage for a procedure that far exceeds what 62A14 I think originally intended. And I mean, I'm going to save this for later, but I think we have some utilization impacts that aren't being addressed as well, and I think it applies to this. This section four of this as well. I mean, it's diagnosis of infertility, voluntary planning of conception, bearing children, testing and treatment of an STD, testing for AIDS. I mean, that's very different and has very different cost centers than a surgical procedure. So that's why I think that Representative New Brindley's amendment is, we should vote yes, or at least address this moving forward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. And I just want to note for folks that we can go until 12:30. And if we do not finish our agenda, we will come back after we have been approved to come back after floor session this evening. I hope that won't be necessary. I think we should be able to get through our agenda here by 12:30. Any further discussion on the A7? All right. So all in favor of adoption of the A7 amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. Motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Okay, we will go to discussion on the bill. Representative Nadeau, you were on the list first for discussion on the bill. Did you want to speak to it?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm going to go super quick. Thank you, Representative Stevenson, for bringing the bill. Representative New Brindley answered my question in Section 4. And I have one question in the underlying bill starting at line 3.13. It has to do with this cost-sharing thing that I think I'm having a little bit of fits with, carving out a lack of cost-sharing for a particular procedure, and I'm not knowledgeable about other procedures that we don't require cost-sharing for. But can, in starting in line 3.13, can you explain to me, starting at the minimum level necessary to preserve an enrollee's ability to make tax-exempt contributions and withdrawals? I mean, can you give me some background, better understanding on that?
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Nadeau, as introduced, the bill's intention was to not allow for cost sharing for abortion care for the reasons I articulated when we were discussing the amendment a minute ago. We were worried about discriminatory pricing designed to discourage people from getting abortions. We addressed that in the A5 amendment allowing for cost sharing. But we could not prohibit cost sharing as applied to an HSA plan because that would violate sort of the requirements of what an HSA plan is. So this is designed to minimize cost sharing requirements in those high deductible plans while still allowing it to be consistent with federal law. And again, the concern that I have about cost sharing is not, I don't have a problem really with the argument that Representative Brindley made at all, and that's why we incorporated that in the A5 amendment. What I am concerned about is discriminatory pricing designed not to allow for cost sharing, but to just discourage people from having this this care for political or other reasons.
Representative Nadeau?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Stevenson. My last question, I mean, I want to make a bit of a clarification. There was yourself and one testifier basically said that that the plans under Minshew do not cover abortions, and I don't think that's accurate. I think they do, in fact, they do cover abortions. And for, you know, for life of the mother, certain instances, they do require those things. They don't in other cases because their federal funding is prohibited from providing those services. So I wanted to be clear about that, that it already is provided in some cases. And taking that to the next step, starting in line 3.24 in abortion services, where we're basically pulling out that medical, we're pulling that language out for medical necessity. And I believe that this change is going to have a utilization impact in the case of where a provider may not be delivering certain services under their current contract. So I don't think there's any way to determine the utilization and therefore cost in those public programs. And does that, maybe I'm wrong, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, but that is concerning to me that we don't know what the cost to our public programs could be because we don't have that utilization estimate to look at. Am I missing something?
Representative Stevenson.
First of all, if I realized I was a little ambiguous, or a little imprecise in my answer to your last question, in that the language you were asking about was actually removed by the A5 amendment. So I explained why it was there, but the A5 amendment removes the language that you were asking about the high deductible plans all together. And I also did want to clarify, I mean, you're saying that some plans do cover abortion. I have, and I'm happy to share with you, the exclusion language for all of the plans on Minshew, and they all exclude abortion. They do have some exceptions for cases of rape, incest, so on and so forth. And there are, but for the vast majority of abortions that in Minnesota, these exclusions would prohibit coverage, and that's evidenced by the statistic that I had at the beginning of my presentation telling you that despite the fact that we only have a 5% insurance rate, 25% of abortions in Minnesota were paid for out of pocket. So there is a coverage gap there, most certainly. You're correct that the fiscal note does say that the cost of the public programs is indeterminable, and I think you maybe articulated the reason why I was a little distracted because, I was trying to make sure that I had spoken correctly to your last question while you were asking your next one. But my personal view is that it's probably de minimis impact on the public programs, but I have to concede what the fiscal note says is that it's indeterminable.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. So I have Representative Backer and then New Brindley. Representative Backer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, the author of the bill. You know, we know, I think it's going to be obvious that I will not support this. We know that taxpayers, on a pretty recent poll, 58% of Americans oppose tax dollars to pay for abortion, excuse me. And as this gets out, I think we're going to see the same thing, that insurance customers will not want to pay for someone else's abortion for a couple of reasons. We have this false narrative, and I know I will jazz some people up, I get it, but we have this false narrative that abortion is life-supporting care. And the statistics don't show it. First of all, we lose a life. We lose a life. That is a fact. As an EMT, I'm called to uphold life, and I will continue to do that in this role. We also find that abortion affects to that woman future childbearing and pregnancy. They are, unfortunately, 3.3 times higher to have a stillbirth or lose the next birth after an abortion. So we don't see improved health care. That's what insurance is there to pay for, enhanced health care. We also know that after an abortion, women have a higher risk of breast cancer. And then finally, we haven't even talked about the mental health of that person, unfortunately, the woman. We know after an abortion, women generally have an increase in depression, decrease of self-esteem, regret for 5 years after that. And, of course, that means, and I have great sympathy for people with that. That's why I volunteer as an EMT. So I'm not saying this to be insensitive. I do not know all the circumstances when people face. But at the same time, this is going to increase health care. If we are talking about providing health care and this negative notion that abortion is health care, it is not life-supporting care. It actually harms the baby, it harms the woman, and it harms other people. And that's why I cannot support that. So thank you for allowing me to share that, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Becker. You know, there are a lot of falsehoods in what you just said, and I think because we're a health committee, it's really important that we not put out to the public real misinformation. And so I wonder if there was a physician here who testified. I wonder if, or Representative Stevenson, do you have someone who maybe could respond to some of these things that were just stated as facts? Because a lot of this has been completely debunked and just isn't accurate.
Madam Chair, I'm talking from fact.
Well, Representative, I would ask, you're interrupting me, Representative Becker.
I am interrupting you because you're saying.
Representative Becker, you do not have the floor. And we're going to ask someone who has expertise to respond to some of those statements that you just made, because I think accuracy is important here. So please restate your name, and if you could kind of respond if you were listening to some of the things that were stated.
Yes, this is Nicole Chasen again, family physician. What I did hear was around mental health, and there is absolutely no evidence that abortion affects the future mental health. It's no different than any other life experience that people have gone through. There's been no evidence for that. I also heard a statistic around increased rates of stillbirth after abortion, and again, no evidence to support that. Abortion is a very safe procedure. There has been no increased health risk associated with abortion. Was there anything else that I missed?
Breast cancer.
Oh, and breast cancer, yes. Absolutely, no increased risk of breast cancer. That has been disproven on several occasions. There's multiple studies around that. And these are looking at big cohort studies that have looked across many different countries, looking at people of all ages. There's been no increased risk of harm from abortion care.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Stevens, and actually, Dr., and I apologize, I don't know, is it Chasen? Chasen, I'm wondering, I was listening to your testimony, I'm wondering if you'd be willing to clarify something for me. I was listening to your testimony, and you mentioned PMAP and the trouble you have specifically with PMAP. Can you talk a little bit more about that for us?
It's the exception language. There should not be exceptions for abortion care. Yeah.
Madam Chair.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sorry.
My question is, so right now there are exceptions and PMAP does not cover every abortion?
Dr. Chasen.
That is correct.
Okay. There are exceptions for PMAP. There, I mean, well, with PMAP, PMAP is the Medicaid products. They will eventually, but there still are these exceptions that are there, and that's part of what's the problem with the MNSURE. If you go onto the exchange as somebody who doesn't meet the criteria for Medicaid, then the MNSURE exchange does not cover abortion as well for folks who are searching for reproductive health care.
Okay. Representative Brindley, final point, because we really need to move on and lay the bill over.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to understand this. You know, as I look at the fiscal note, it talks about commerce and MMB. This is subject to defrayal. And so I'm wondering why was any data requested from DHS regarding any potential costs, or why the assumption that there would be no cost to MA?
I don't know if maybe Mr. Harney could respond to that.
Madam Chair, members, Representative Stevenson mentioned the DHS response on page 11. Articulates that the change in the language may have a utilization impact in the case that a provider may deliver services that they may not have under the current construct, but the department doesn't have the data to estimate and inform an estimate on that utilization impact.
Okay. So, Madam Chair.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So that is important. So there will be a cost there. We just don't know what it is. That I just want to make sure we understand that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, okay. So with that, I don't know, Representative Stevenson, do you have any really small final word?
It's a good bill. I hope you include it.
All right. Thank you very much. So with that, House File 4053 as amended. Let's see, is this a first engrossment or something? First engrossment? No. 4053 as amended is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you. All right. Representative Bierman, we're going to and members, we have a hard stop at 12:30, and so we may have to come back tonight, sorry to say, but Representative Bierman is going to move that House File 4870 be laid over for possible inclusion, and he has an author's amendment, the A3, to put the bill in the form in which he'd like to discuss it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the A3.
All right, and that looks like just adding an effective date. So all in favor of adoption of the A3, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A3 is adopted to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members, for hearing House File 4870. Members, the community health needs assessment process is a federal requirement for nonprofit hospitals. A community health assessment can provide comprehensive information about a community's current health status, needs, and issues. Federal guidelines and rules, however, leave it to states to determine much of the oversight, such as community benefit and charity care reporting and measurement of public health improvements. The purpose of House File 4870 is to continue to clarify reporting standards for hospitals in Minnesota to improve community participation and improve measurement of targeted health outcomes in the neighborhoods of area hospitals. Members, this bill seeks more uniformity and transparency in reporting to the public and helps focus efforts on the health issues most important for our local community members. States across the nation have been investigating the relationship between a nonprofit hospital's tax-exempt status and the level of community benefit they provide. Massachusetts has created a determination of need process to address public health goals. Illinois has a law on matching direct tax exemption to meeting community benefit requirements. Pennsylvania has established specific criteria that a nonprofit hospital must satisfy to qualify as exempt from Pennsylvania's property and sales tax. Montana carried out robust audits to assess the impacts of tax exemption to return on investment of community benefit spending. The findings in Montana showed that current community benefit spending has a negligible impact on creating better health outcomes in communities. And there's more states, and I'll just mention two more. New Jersey tax court ruling determined the operation and function of modern nonprofit hospitals do not meet the criteria of tax exemption. They now tax hospitals $3 per bed per day if they miss the mark. 46 out of 56 hospitals missed the mark. Utah requires nonprofit hospitals to establish that its total community benefits benefits exceeds on an annual basis its tax liability for that year. Members, yesterday there was news that the IRS is reviewing the tax-exempt qualification for nonprofit hospitals, and there are some implications that tax-exempt hospitals are not satisfying the operational test for tax exemption, so there is much more to come. The bill before you today, however, does not propose any punitive actions toward hospitals. It will simply provide for more information to be more readily available to the public to broaden their ability to participate in defining what goes into the required federal assessment and action plan, and creates the potential for more impact to improve health needs facing their communities. Madam Chair, I have a few people to speak on the bill, and we can move to that now.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bierman. I just want to say I vastly misstated what the amendment was because it deletes large sections of the original bill. So I just want to make sure that people understand that. So, and thank you for your explanation of what is remains after your amendment. So it deleted sections 1 and 2. It deleted section 4. So we're really working on section 3 of the bill here.
Thank you for the clarification.
Thank you. Okay, so let's try to see if we can get through some testimony here. And so, Mr. Baglio, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Ben Baglio. I use he, him pronouns, and I'm with the Minnesota Nurses Association. Thank you for allowing me to testify in support of House File 4870, a bill to address some of the existing shortcomings in oversight of tax-exempt hospitals. These shortcomings stem largely from broad federal rules, but they're exacerbated at the state level when states like our own do not create additional safeguards to preserve and protect our healthcare delivery system. Almost all of Minnesota's hospitals are run by tax-exempt or nonprofit organizations that receive millions in local, state, and federal tax breaks annually in return for their statutory obligation to operate as a public good. Unfortunately, neither federal or state laws have ever come close to appropriately regulating what a fair share is in return for those lucrative tax breaks, especially in the age of massive healthcare corporations running most of Minnesota's state hospitals. A report published last week from the Lown Institute shows that Minnesota's tax-exempt hospitals took in $1.1 billion more in tax breaks in 2021 than they gave back to communities through charity care or other community benefit programs. Allina, Fairview, and Health Partners each had a fair share deficit that exceeded $100 million, while the Mayo Clinic system-wide fair share deficit of $478 million earned it a place in the top 10 worst system deficits in the nation. The Lown Institute, along with the U.S. Government Accountability Office and nonpartisan organizations like the National Academy for State Health Policy, have all called for creating regulations to provide for more financial accountability and transparency. Their policy recommendations include those like the provisions in House File 4870, which will improve one of the tools created under the ACA, the Community Health Needs Assessment. This bill will create some level of accountability around how CHNAs are conducted and reported, and we hope that this will get us moving towards larger reforms like establishing community benefit standards here in Minnesota. This will help us address the overinflated numbers reported by hospitals in their community benefits spending and will protect patient care. With that, I'd just like to thank Representative Bierman for carrying this bill and Representative Elkins, Fisher, and Smith for co-authoring. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Sorry for mispronouncing your name. Probably not the first time either. Mr. Welch, John Welch, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is John Welch, and I'm a registered nurse, and I work in the Med-Surg unit at Unity Hospital in Fridley. I'm proud to be testifying today on behalf of the 23,000 registered nurses that make up the Minnesota Nurses Association, where I serve as chairman of the Government Affairs Commission. Our union, which represents 80% of the active nurses that work at the bedside in hospitals across the state, is in full support of House File 4870. Much of MNA's work this session has been dedicated to supporting healthcare policy reforms so that me and my fellow nurses can provide the quality care that we got in this profession to deliver. And we feel increased financial transparency and accountability across hospitals and efforts like those in this bill will safeguard our state healthcare delivery system. While we're disappointed that the language originally found in Section 2 is being removed, I want to express our support for fixing the existing Community Health Needs Assessment, or the CHNA process that was created under the ACA. The ACA requires tax-exempt hospitals to conduct a CHNA every 3 years to identify the greatest needs of the community they serve and then develop a plan to meet those needs. Unfortunately, the federal guidelines that governs how those needs assessments are done are leveraged across the community health needs, are poorly defined, and insufficiently regulated. However, many states have created laws to improve the CHNA process in their state in order to safeguard patient care and by ensuring hospitals are prioritizing community health needs when establishing their budgets and policies, and that they're fairly delivering on these responsibilities in return for the massive tax breaks they receive. House File 4870 would create the reporting requirements that Minnesota has been desperately needing in order to make sure these massive tax-exempt health care systems are actually putting their money where their mouths are when it comes to addressing the health needs of our state's communities. We ask you to support this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Mary Krenke? Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the record, my name is Mary Krenke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. First, I just want to recognize that the Hospital Association is very grateful for Representative Bierman's narrowing the scope of this bill and focusing in on the community health needs assessment and community benefit reporting. With the passage of the Affordable Care Act in 2010, there were two requirements of nonprofit hospitals. The first one was that we have to complete what's known as a Schedule H form on the 990, and we also have to complete a comprehensive community health needs assessment at least once every 3 years. It must include an implementation strategy, as well as we have to publish that on our websites. So that is work that we are already doing. Representative Bierman's bill does add that we have to send that community health needs assessment to the Department of Health now as well. So what's new in House File 4870? There's a new section that requires an annual addendum to be filed with very granular information about the policies, procedures, costs, metrics, and methodologies used to calculate community health improvement services. Now, I just want to make two comments and then a closing comment. And I did have an opportunity to visit with Representative Bierman before the hearing. The bill has an effective date of January 1, and that is really not practical for capturing the previous year's community benefits. So we are suggesting an implementation date of July 1st for reporting the previous year's community benefits. So what we're suggesting here is that July 1, 2025 would capture all the community benefit activities of 2024. That would be very difficult to report on January 1st. The second thing we want to point out is we want to continue to work with Representative Bierman to ensure there is alignment with the benefit categories already defined by the IRS. And if there is more detail in the reporting, that would be on the new addendum. And in closing, and I know it's past my time, I just want to comment on something that a previous testifier said regarding the loan study. They cherry-picked categories using just a couple of the currently broad categories under the IRS definitions. And if you're going to not count 75% of all the categories of community benefit, of course the numbers will drop. And I am happy to share information with you all and the committee on what we do under community benefit and what was excluded from that loan study. So thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And perhaps Ms. Krenke would stay, because that actually was exactly my question. This loan study, my understanding is that that did not include a great deal of research, training, unreimbursed care. Do you have any idea, is there any quantification for that compared to this, whatever, $1 billion deficit number?
Ms. Krenke.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, every year the hospitals across our state do a community benefit report. Last year's numbers came in at $3.4 billion. Obviously, there can be discussion about what is included and what is not included. From our perspective, we are required by the IRS to report 8 to 10 different categories of community benefit. So we have to follow what the IRS says. So we would suggest that that be the criteria that we use to evaluate our community benefit.
All right. And, you know, so I neglected to ask whether anyone else in the room wants to testify on the bill, which is important because perhaps if we come back this evening, we're not going to ask everyone to come back who might want to. So is there anyone else who wants to testify right now? Okay, not seeing anyone. All right. Did you have something else, Representative Brindley? We have 4 minutes, and Representative Nadeau also had something he wanted to say. If we can wrap up, we might not have to come back, but if you want to talk more, we certainly can this evening.
Yeah, I will just say thank you for that. And I hope, and Representative Bierman, I appreciate you are always willing to work on things with us, and I appreciate that. I hope that this is something that we will discuss, what exactly that criteria is and how we are evaluating this. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Bierman. So I'm wondering, should, if this is so vital, and this is pretty detailed. I mean, you start on, you know, the addendum. I mean, there's nine. I count nine very, very specific things that we're going to now identify for community health improvements. I mean, anybody that works in this field recognizes that these are long-term spending commitments to try to change people's ultimate health. So I think that's going to be hard to do. But, I mean, should we be applying this to every nonprofit? I mean, every direct service provider, every affordable housing provider that takes advantage of 4% or 9% tax credits, you know, maybe we should start budgeting tax expenditures. I mean, how can we pick on one? I mean, hospitals apparently are flush with cash, way too much money that is just, you know, going out there. I mean, why focus on, why not apply this across the board?
And so, you know what, I'm going to take that as a rhetorical question for now because we have to, well, I think we're going to have to take it offline then, Representative Doe, unless you want to come back this evening. We're going to go into recess and we can talk about whether we want to come back and have more discussion after the floor this evening. So, Representative Bierman, we're really out of time. So let's go into recess. You can maybe talk with Representative Nadeau offline, and we'll see if we need to come back this evening.
Happy to do so.
All right, so the committee's in recess.